Side 14, A Fire Upon the Deep, by Werner Venge, continuing on page 310. The geometry of emergence was enormously favorable to Elvira. They had been on the outskirts of the action, but now they had hours head start on the main fleets. Glimfrella and Tarolo were busier than they had ever been in their lives, monitoring the fleet's emergence and establishing Elvira's identity with the other vessels of commercial security. Until Schritz and Lemonda emerged from the slowness, Kjet Svensendott was the ranking officer of the organization. Furthermore, he was personally known to most of the commanders. Kjet had never been the admiral type. His group captaincy had been a reward for piloting skills in a Chandra K at peace. He had always been content to defer to his employers. But now, the group captain used his ranking status. The Alliance vessels were not pursued. "Wait till we can all act together," ordered Svensendott. Possible game plans bounced back and forth across the emerging fleet, including schemes that assumed HQ was destroyed. With certain commanders, Kjet hinted that this last might be the case, that Lemonda's flagship was in enemy hands, and that the Alliance was somehow just a side effect of that true enemy. Very soon, Kjet would be committed to the treason he planned. The Lemonda flagships and the core of the Blighter fleet came out of the slowness almost simultaneously. Comm alarms went off across Elvira's deck as priority mail arrived and passed through the ship's crypto. "Source, Lemonda at HQ. Starbreaker priority," said the ship's voice. Glimfrella put the message on the main window, and Svensendott felt a chill certainty spread up his neck. "All units are to pursue fleeing vessels. These are the enemy, the killers of our people. Warning, masquerades suspected. Destroy any vessels countermanding these orders. Order of battle and validation codes follow." Order of battle was simple, even by commercial security standards. Lemonda wanted them to split up and be gone, staying only long enough to destroy masqueraders. Kjet said to Glimfrella, "How about the validation codes?" The Dirachemy seemed his usual self again. "They're clean. We wouldn't be receiving the message at all unless the sender had today's one-time pad. We're beginning to receive queries from the others, boss. Audio and video channels. They want to know what to do." If he hadn't prepared the ground during the last few hours, Kjet's mutiny wouldn't have had a chance. If commercial security had been a real military organization, the Lemonda order might have been obeyed without question. As it was, the other commanders pondered the questions that Svensendott had raised. At these ranges, video communication was easy, and the fleet had one-time ciphers large enough to support enormous amounts of it. Yet Lemonda had chosen printed mail for her priority message. It made perfect military sense, given that the encryption was correct, but it was also what Svensendott had predicted. The supposed HQ was not quite willing to show its face down here where perfect visual masquerades were not possible. Their commands would be by mail or evocations that any sharp observer might suspect. Such a slender thread of reason Kjet and his friends were hanging from. Kjet eyed the knot of light that represented the Blighter fleet. It was suffering from no indecision. None of its vessels were straggling back toward safer heights. Whatever commanded there had discipline beyond most human militaries. It would sacrifice everything in its single-minded pursuit of one small starship. "What next, group captain?" Just ahead of that cold smear of light, a single tiny gleam appeared. "The out of band," said Glimfrella. 65 light-years out now." "I'm getting encrypted video from them, boss. The same half-crocked Zor pad as before." He put the signal on the main window without waiting for Kjet's direction. It was Ravna Bergschendott. The background was a jumble of motion and shouting, the strange human and the scrotum rider arguing. Bergschendott was facing away from the pickup and doing her share of shouting. Things looked even worse than Kiet's recollection of the first moments of his ship's emergence.
"It doesn't matter just now, I tell you. Let him be. We've got to contact..."
She must have seen the signal Glemfrella was sending back to her.
"They're here. By the powers, Fom, please."
She waved her hand angrily and turned to the camera.
"Group Captain, we're..."
"I know. We've been out of the surge for hours. We're near the center of the pursuit now."
She caught her breath. Even with 100 hours of planning, events were moving too fast for her. And for me, too.
"That's something," she said after an instant. "Everything we said before holds, Group Captain. We need your help. That's the blight that's coming behind us. Please."
Svensendott noticed a telltale by the window. Sassy Glemfrella was retransmitting this to all the fleet they could trust. Good. He had talked about the situation with the others these last hours, but it meant something more to see Ravna Bergschendott on the comm, to see someone from Chandra K who still survived and needed their help. You can spend the rest of your life chasing revenge in the middle beyond, but all you kill will be the vultures. What's chasing Ravna Bergschendott may be the first cause. The butterflies were long gone, still singing their courage across the net. Less than 1% of commercial security had followed Lemonda's order to chase after them. Those were not the problem. It was the 10% that stayed behind and arrayed themselves with the Blight's forces that bothered Kiet Svensendott. Some of those ships might not be subverted, might simply be loyal to orders they believed. It would be very hard to fire on them. And there would be fighting, no doubt of that. Maneuvering for conflict while under ultra-drive was difficult, if the other side attempted to evade. But the Blight's fleet was unwavering in its pursuit of the out-of-band. Slowly, slowly, the two fleets were coming to occupy the same volume. At present, they were scattered across cubic light-years, but with every jump, the group captain's Aniara fleet was more finely tuned to the stutter of their quarry's drives. Some ships were actually within a few 100 million kilometers of the enemy, or where the enemy had been or would be. Targeting tactics were set. First fire was only a few 100 seconds away.
"With the Aprahante gone, we have numerical superiority. A normal enemy would back off now. But, of course, that is one thing the Blight Fleet is not."
It was the red-haired guy who was doing the talking now. It was a good thing Glemfrella hadn't relayed his phase to the rest of Svensendott's fleet. The guy acted edgy and alien most of the time. Just now he seemed intent on bashing every idea Svensendott advanced.
"The Blight doesn't care what its losses are, as long as it arrives with the upper hand."
Svensendott shrugged.
"Look, we'll do our best. First fire is 150 seconds off. If they don't have any secret advantage, we may win this one."
He looked sharply at the other.
"Or is that your point? Could the Blight..."
Stories were still coming down about the Blight's progress across the top of the beyond. Without a doubt, it was a transhuman intelligence. An unarmed man might be outnumbered by a pack of dogs, yet still defeat them. So might the Blight. Fom Nguyen shook his head.
"No, no, no. The Blight's tactics down here will probably be inferior to yours. Its great advantage is at the top, where it can control its slaves like fingers on a hand. Its creatures down here are like badly synced Waldos."
Nguyen frowned at something off-camera.
"No, what we have to fear is its strategic cleverness."
His voice suddenly had a detached quality that was more unsettling than the earlier impatience. It wasn't the calm of someone facing up to a threat. It was more the calm of the demented.
100 seconds to contact. Group Captain, We have a chance if you concentrate your forces on the right points.
Ravna floated down from the top of the picture, put one hand on the redhead's shoulder. God-shatter, she said he was, their secret edge against the enemy. God-shatter, a power's dying message. Garbage or treasure, who really knew?
Damn, if the other guys are badly synced Waldos, what does following Fom Nguyen make us? But he motioned to Rolla to mark the targets that Nguyen was saying.
90 seconds. Decision time. Kiet pointed at the red marks Rolla had scattered through the enemy fleet.
Anything special about those targets, Rolla?
The Dirachemi whistled for a moment. Correlations popped up agonizingly slowly on the windows before him.
The ships he's targeting aren't the biggest or the fastest. It's going to take extra time to position on them.
Command vessels?
One other thing. Some of them show high real velocities, not natural residuals at all.
Ships with ram drives? Planet busters?
Svensson Dopp looked at the display just a second more. 30 seconds and Yo Haoyan's ship, Lunschnar, would be in contact, but not with one of Nguyen's targets.
Get on the comm, Glimfella. Tell Lunschnar to back off. Retarget.
Retarget everything.
The lights that were Aniara fleet slid slowly around the core of the Blighter fleet, searching for their new targets. 20 minutes passed, and not a few arguments with the other captains. Commercial security was not built for military combat. What had made Kiet Svensson-Dott's appeal successful was also the cause of constant questioning and counter-suggestions. And then there were the threats that came from Owner Lemenda's channel. Kill the mutineers, death to all those disloyal to the company. The encryption was valid, but the tone was totally alien to the mild, profit-oriented Yiske Lemenda. Everyone could now see that disbelieving Lemenda was one correct decision anyway.
Johanna Haoyan was the first to achieve sync with the new targets. Glimfrella opened the main window on the Lunschnar's data stream. The view was almost natural, a night sky of slowly shifting stars. The target was less than 30 million kilometers from Lunschnar, but about a millisecond out of sync. Haoyan was arriving just before or just after the other had jumped.
Drones away, Haoyan's voice said. Now they had a true view of Lunschnar from a few meters away, from a camera aboard one of the first drones launched. The ship was barely visible, a darkness obscuring the stars beyond, a great fish in the depths of an endless sea, a fish that was now giving spawn. The picture flickered, Lunschnar disappearing and reappearing as the drone lost sync momentarily. A swarm of blue lights spilled from the ship's hold, weapon drones. The swarm hung by Lunschnar, calibrating itself, orienting on the enemy. The light faded from around Lunschnar as the drones moved fractionally out of sync in space and time. Tarola opened a window on 100 million click sphere centered at Lunschnar. The target vessel was a red dot that flickered around the sphere like a maddened insect. Lunschnar was stalking prey at 8,000 times the speed of light. Sometimes the target disappeared for a second, sync almost lost. Other times, Lunschnar and the target merged for an instant as the two craft spent a tenth of a second at less than 1 million kilometers remove. What could not be accurately displayed was the disposition of the drones. The spawn diffused on a myriad trajectories, their sensors extended for sign of the enemy ship.
What about the target? Is it swarming back? Do you need backup? Said Svensson Dutt.
Tarola gave a Dirachemi shrug. What they were watching was 3 light-years away. No way he could know.
But Yo Haoyan replied,
I don't think my bogey is swarming. I've lost only 5 drones, no more'n you'd expect from near misses. We'll see.
She paused, but Lunschnar's trace and signal remained strong. Kiet looked out the other windows.
Five of Aniara were already engaged, and three had completed swarm deploy. Nguyen looked on silently from out of band. The God-Shatter had had its way, and now Kiet and his people were committed. And now good news and bad came in very fast. "Got him!" from Yo Haoyan. The red dot in Lunshnar's swarm was no more. It had passed within a few thousand kilometers of one of the drones. In the milliseconds necessary to compute a new jump, the drone had discovered its presence and detonated. Even that would not have been fatal if the target had jumped before the blast front hit it. There had been several near misses in earlier seconds. This time, the jump did not reach commit in time. A mini-star was born, one whose like would be years in reaching the rest of the battle volume. Glimfrella gave a rasping whistle, an untranslatable curse.
"We just lost Oblishan Dot and Holder, boss. Their target must have counter-swarmed."
"Send in Gleaving and Trance."
Something in the back of his head curled up in a knot of horror. These were his friends who were dying. Kiet had seen death before, but never like this. In police action, no one took lethal chances except in a rescue. And yet, he turned from the field summary to order more ships on a target that had acquired defending vessels. Tarola was moving in others on his own. Ganging up a few non-essential targets might lose in the long run, but in the short term, the enemy was being hurt. For the first time since the fall of Chandra K, commercial security was hurting someone back. Haoyan.
"Powers, that guy was moving. Secondary drone got EM spectrum on the kill. Target was going 15,000 kilometers per second true speed.
A rocket bomb ramping up? Damn. They should be postponing those till after they controlled the battlefield."
Tarola.
"More kills far side of battle volume. The enemy is repositioning. Somehow they've guessed which we're after."
Glimfrella.
Triumph whistle.
"Get him, get him. Oops.
Boss, I think Glimenda has figured we're coordinating things."
A new window had opened over Tarola's post. It showed the 5 million kilometers around Ulvira. Two other ships were there now. The window identified them as Glimenda's flag and one of the vessels that had not responded to Svensson Dot's recruiting. There was an instant of stillness on Ulvira's command deck. The voices of triumph and panic coming from the rest of the fleet seemed suddenly far away. Svensson Dot and his crew looked at death close up.
"Tarola, how long till swarm?"
"They're on us already. Just missed a drone by 10 milliseconds.
"Tarola, finish running current engagements.
Glimfrella, tell Lunshnar and Trance to chain command if we lose contact."
Those ships had already spent their drones, and Yo Haoyan was known to all the other captains. Then the thought was gone, and he was busy coordinating Ulvira's own battle swarm. The local tactics window showed the cloud dissipating, taking on colors coded by whether they were lagging or leading relative to Ulvira. Their two attackers had matched pseudo-speeds perfectly. 10 times per second, all three ships jumped a tiny fraction of a light year. Like rocks skipping across the surface of a pond, they appeared in real space in perfectly measured hops, and the distance between them at every emergence was less than 5 million kilometers. The only thing that separated them now were millisecond differences in jump times and the fact the light itself could not pass between them in the brief time they spent at each jump point. Three actinic flashes lit the deck, casting shadows back from Svensson Dot and the Dirachmes. It was second-hand light, the display's emergency signal of nearby detonation. Run like hell was the message any rational person should take from that awful light. It would be easy enough to break sync and lose tactical control of Aniara fleet. Tarola and Glimfrella bent their heads away from the local window, shying from the glare of nearby death. Their whistling voices scarcely broke cadence, and the commands from Ulvira to the others continued. There were dozens of other battles going on out there.
Just now, Elvira was the only source of precision and control available to their side. Every second they remained on station meant protection and advantage to Aniara. Breaking off would mean minutes of chaos till Lunshnar or Transa could pick up control. Nearly two-thirds of Fom Nuwen's targets were destroyed now. The price had been high, half of Svensson Dot's friends. The enemy had lost much to protect those targets, yet much of its fleet survived. An unseen hand smashed Elvira, driving Svensson Dot hard against his combat harness. The lights went out, even the glow from the windows. Then dim red light came from the floor. The Dirachamese were silhouetted by one small monitor. Rollo whistled softly.
"We're out of the game, boss, least while it counts." "I didn't know you could get misses that near."
Maybe it wasn't a miss. Kiet scrambled out of his harness and boosted across the room to float head down over the tiny monitor. Maybe we're already dead. Somewhere very close by, a drone had detonated, the wave front reaching Elvira before she jumped. The concussion had been the outer part of the ship's hull exploding as it absorbed the soft X-ray component of the enemy ordnance. He stared at the red letters marching slowly across the damage display. Most likely, the electronics was permanently dead. Chances were they had all received a fatal dose of gamma. The smell of burnt insulation floated across the room on the ventilator's breeze.
"Yeah, look at that. 5 nanoseconds more and we wouldn't have been clipped at all. We actually jumped after the front hit."
And somehow the electronics had survived long enough to complete the jump. The gamma flux through the command deck had been 200 rem, nothing that would slow them down over the next few hours and easily managed by a ship's surgeon. As for the surgeon and all the rest of the Elvira's automation... Torella typed several long queries at the box. There was no voice recognition left. Several seconds passed before a response marched across the screen.
"Central automation suspended. Display management suspended. Drive computation suspended."
Torella dug an elbow at his brother.
"Hi, fella. It looks like Vera managed a clean disconnect. We can bring most of this back."
Dirachamese were known for being drifty optimists, but in this case, Torella wasn't far from the truth. Their encounter with the drone bomb had been a one-in-a-billion thing, the tiniest fraction of an exposure. Over the next hour and a half, the Dirachamese ran reboots off the monitor's hardened processor, bringing up first one utility and then another. Some things were beyond recovery. Parsing intelligence was gone from the comm automation, and the ultra-drive spines on one side of the craft were partially melted. Absurdly, the burning smell had been a vagrant diagnostic, something that should have been disabled along with all the rest of Elvira's automation. They were far behind the Blighter fleet. And there was still a Blighter fleet. The knot of enemy lights was smaller than before, but on the same unwavering trajectory. The battle was long over. What was left of commercial security was scattered across 4 light-years of abandoned battlefield. They had started the battle with numerical superiority. If they'd fought properly, they might have won. Instead, they'd destroyed the vessels with significant real velocities and knocked out only about half the others. Some of the largest enemy vessels survived. These outnumbered the corresponding Aniara survivors by more than 4 to 1. The Blight could have easily destroyed all that remained of commercial security, but that would have meant a detour from the pursuit, and that pursuit was the one constant in the enemy's behavior. Torella and Glemfrella spent hours re-establishing communications and trying to discover who had died and who might be rescued. 5 ships had lost all drive capability but still had surviving crew. Some ships had been hit at known locations, and Svensson Dot dispatched vessels with drone swarms to find the wrecks. Ship-to-ship warfare was a sanitary, intellectual exercise for most of the survivors, but the rubble and the destruction were as real as in any ground war, only spread over 1 trillion times more space.
Finally, the time for miracle rescues and sad discoveries was past. The SJK commanders gathered on a common channel to decide a common future. It might better have been a wake for Chandra K and Aniara fleet. Partway through the meeting, a new window appeared, a view onto the bridge of the out-of-band. Ravna Bergshendot watched the proceedings silently. The erstwhile God-shatter was nowhere in evidence.
"What more to do?" said Johanna Haujen. "The damn butterflies are long gone."
"Are we sure we have rescued everyone?" asked Jan Tranglitz.
Svensendot bit back an angry reply. The commander of Transa had become a recording loop on that issue. He had lost too many friends in the battle. All the rest of his life, Jan Tranglitz would live with nightmares of ships slowly dying in the deep night.
"We've accounted for everything, even to vapor," Haujen spoke as gently as the words allowed. "The question is where to go now?"
Ravna made a small throat-clearing sound.
"Gentlemen and ladies, if..."
Tranglitz looked up at her transceived image. All his hurt transformed into a blaze of anger.
"We're not your gentlemen, slut. You're not some princess we happily die for. You deserve our deadly fire now, nothing more."
The woman shrank from Tranglet's rage.
"You put us into this suicidal battle," shouted Tranglet. "You made us attack secondary targets, and then you did nothing to help. The blight is locked on you like a dumb shark on a squid. If you had just altered your course the tiniest fraction, you could have thrown the blighters off our path."
"I doubt that would have helped, sir," said Ravna. "The blight seems most interested in where we're bound."
"The solar system a few dozen light-years beyond the out-of-band. The fugitives would arrive there just over 2 days before their pursuers." Johaujen shrugged.
"You must realize what your friend's crazy battle plan has done. If we had attacked rationally, the enemy would be a fraction of its present size. If it chose to continue, we might have been able to protect you at this Tynes world."
She seemed to taste the strange name, wondering at its meaning.
"Now, no way am I going to chase them there. What's left of the enemy could wipe us out."
She glanced at Svensendot's viewpoint. Kiet forced himself to look back. No matter who might blame the out-of-band, it had been Group Captain Kiet Svensendot's word that had persuaded the fleet to fight as they did. Aniara's sacrifice had been ill-spent, and he wondered that Haujen and Tranglitz and the others talked to him at all now.
"Suggest we continue the business meeting later. Rendezvous in 1,000 seconds, Kiet."
"I'll be ready."
"Good."
Yo cut the link without saying anything more to Ravna Bergshendot. Seconds later, Tranglitz and the other commanders were gone. It was just Svensendot and the two Dirachamis, and Ravna Bergshendot looking out her window from the out-of-band. Finally, Bergshendot said,
"When I was a little girl on Herta, sometimes we would play kidnappers and commercial security. I always dreamed of being rescued from fates worse than death by your company."
Kiet smiled bleakly.
"Well, you got the rescue attempt.
And you're not even a currently subscribed customer.
This was far the biggest gunfight we've ever been in."
"I'm sorry, Kiet. Group Captain."
He looked into her dark features. Alas, from Chandra K down to the violet eyes. No way this could be a simulation, not here. He had bet everything that she was not. He still believed she was not. Yet.
"What does your friend say about all this?"
Pom Nguyen had not been seen since his so impressive God-shatter act at the beginning of the battle. Ravna's glance shifted to something off-camera.
"He's not saying much, Group Captain. He's wandering around, even more upset than your Captain Tranglitz. Fom remembers being absolutely convinced he was demanding the right thing, but now he can't figure out why it was right."
A little late for second thoughts. "What are you going to do now? Haujen is right, you know. It would be useless suicide for us to follow the blighters to your destination. I dare say it's useless suicide for you, too. You'll arrive maybe 55 hours before them. What can you do in that time?
Ravna Bergschendott looked back at him, and her expression slowly collapsed into sobbing grief.
I don't know. I don't know.
She shook her head, her face hidden behind her hands and a sweep of black hair. Finally, she looked up and brushed back her hair. Her voice was calm but very quiet.
I don't know, but we are going ahead. It's what we came for. Things could still work out. You know, there's something down there, something the Blight wants desperately. Maybe 55 hours is enough to figure out what it is and tell the net, and we'll still have Fom's Godshatter.
Your worst enemy? Quite possibly this Fom Nguyen was a construct of the powers. He certainly looked like something built from a second-hand description of humanity. But how can you tell Godshatter from simple nuttery? She shrugged, as if acknowledging the doubts and accepting them.
So what will you and commercial security do?
There is no commercial security anymore. Virtually all our customers got shot out from under us. Now we've killed our company's owner, or at least destroyed her ship and those supporting her. We are Aniara Fleet now.
It was the official name chosen at the fleet conference just ended. There was a certain grim pleasure in embracing it, the ghost from before Chandra Kay and before New Yora, from the earliest times of the human race. For they were truly cast away now, from their worlds and their customers and their former leaders. 100 ships bound for...
We talked it over. A few still wanted to follow you to Tyne's world. Some of the crews want to return to the middle beyond, spend the rest of their lives killing butterflies. The majority want to start the races of Chandra Kay over again, someplace where we won't be noticed, someplace where no one cares if we live.
And the one thing everyone agreed on was that Aniara must be split no further, must make no further sacrifices outside of itself. Once that was clear, it was easy to decide what to do. In the wake of the great surge, this part of the bottom was an incredible froth of slowness and beyond. It would be centuries before the xenographic vessels from above had reasonable maps of the new interface. Hidden away in the folds and interstices were worlds fresh from the slowness, worlds where Chandra Kay could be born again.
New Chandra Kay?
He looked across the bridge at Tarola and Glimfrella. They were busy bringing the main navigation processors out of suspension. That wasn't absolutely necessary for the rendezvous with Lundschnar, but things would be a lot more convenient if both ships could maneuver. The brothers seemed oblivious to Kiet's conversation with Ravna, and maybe they weren't paying attention. In a way, the Aniara decision meant more to them than to the humans of the fleet. No one doubted that millions of humans survived in the beyond, and who knew how many human worlds might still exist in the slowness, distant cousins of New Yora, distant children of old Earth. But this side of the Transcend, the Dairakamis of Aniara were the only ones that existed. The dream habitats of Chandra Kay were gone, and with them, the race. There were at least 1,000 Dairakamis left aboard Aniara, pairs of sisters and brothers scattered across 100 vessels. These were the most adventurous of their race's latter days, and now they were faced with their greatest challenge. The two on Elvira had already been scouting among the survivors looking for friends and dreaming a new reality. Ravna listened solemnly to his explanations.
Group Captain, xenography is a tedious thing, and your ships are near their limits. In this froth, he might search for years and not find a new home.
We're taking precautions. We're abandoning all our ships except the ones with ram scoop and cold sleep capability. We'll operate in coordinated nets. No one should be lost for more than a few years. He shrugged. And if we never find what we seek?
If we die between the stars as our life support finally fails,
Well, then we will have still lived true to our name.
Aniara.
I think we have a chance. More than can be said for you.
Ravna nodded slowly. Yes, well, it helps me to know that.
They talked a few minutes more, Tirola and Glemfrella joining in. They had been at the center of something vast, but as usual, with the affairs of the powers, no one knew quite what had happened, nor the result of the strivings. Rendezvous Lunschnar, 200 seconds, said the ship's voice.
Ravna heard it, nodded. She raised her hand. Fare you well, Kjet Svensendot, and Tirola, and Glemfrella.
The Dirachamese whistled back the common farewell, and Svensendot raised his hand. The window on Ravna Bergshendot closed. Kjet Svensendot remembered her face all the rest of his life, though in later years it seemed more and more to be the same as Elvira's. Part 3. Chapter 37.
Time's world! I can see it, Fom!
The main window showed a true view upon the system, a sun less than 200 million kilometers away, daylight across the command deck. The positions of identified planets were marked with blinking red arrows, but one of those, just 20 million kilometers off, was labeled Terrestrial. Coming off an interstellar jump, you couldn't get positioning much better than that. Fom didn't reply, just glared out the window as if there were something wrong with what they were seeing. Something had broken in him after the battle with the Blight. He'd been so sure of his God-shatter, and so bewildered by the consequences. Afterwards, he had retreated more than ever. Now he seemed to think that if they moved fast enough, the surviving enemy could do them no harm. More than ever, he was suspicious of Blue Shell and Greenstalk, as if somehow they were greater threats than the ships that still pursued.
Damn, Fom said finally. Look at the relative velocity.
70 kilometers per second. Position matching was no problem, but...
Matching velocities will cost us time, Sir Fom.
Fom's stare turned on Blue Shell.
We talked this out with the locals 3 weeks ago, remember? You managed the burn.
And you checked my work, Sir Fom. This must be another nav system bug, though I didn't expect anything was wrong in simple ballistics.
A sign inverted 70 clicks per second, closing velocity, instead of zero. Blue Shell drifted toward the secondary console.
Maybe, said Fom. Just now, I want you off the deck, Blue Shell.
But I can help. We should be contacting Yefri and rematching velocities and...
Get off the deck, Blue Shell. I don't have time to watch you anymore.
Fom dived across the intervening space and was met by Ravna just short of the rider. She floated between the two, talking fast.
It's okay, Fom. He'll go.
She brushed her hand across one of Blue Shell's wildly vibrating fronds. After a second, Blue Shell wilted.
I'll go. I'll go.
She kept an encouraging touch on him, and kept herself between him and Fom as the scroter rider made a dejected exit. When the rider was gone, she turned to Fom.
Couldn't it have been a nav bug, Fom?
The other didn't seem to hear the question. The instant the hatch had closed, he had returned to the command console. OOB's latest estimate put the Blight's arrival less than 53 hours away. And now they must waste time redoing a velocity match supposedly accomplished 3 weeks earlier.
Somebody, something, screwed us over,
Fom was muttering, even as he finished with the control sequence.
Maybe it was a bug. This next damn burn is going to be as manual as it can be.
Acceleration alarms echoed down the core of the OOB.
Fom flipped through monitor windows, searching for loose items that might be big enough to be dangerous. You tie down, too.
He reached out to override the 5-minute timer. Ravna dived back across the deck, unfolding the freefall saddle into a seat and strapping in. She heard Fom speaking on the general announce channel, warning of the timer override. Then the impulse drive cut in, a lazy pressure back into the webbing. 0.4 G. All the poor OOB could still manage. When Fom said manual, he meant it. The main window appeared to be bore-centered now. The view didn't drift at the whim of the pilot, and there were no helpful legends and schematics. As much as possible, they were seeing true view along OOB's main axis. Peripheral windows were held in fixed geometry with main. Fom's eyes flickered from one to another as his hands played over the command board. As near as could be, he was flying by his own senses and trusting no one else. But Fom still had use for the ultra drive. They were 20 million clicks off target, a submicroscopic jump. Fom Nguyen fiddled with the drive parameters, trying to make an accurate jump smaller than the standard interval. Every few seconds, the sunlight would shift a fraction, coming first over Ravna's left shoulder and then her right. It made re-establishing calm with Yefri nearly impossible. Suddenly, the window below their feet was filled by a world, huge and gibbous, blue and swirling white. The Tyne's world was as Yefri Olshan advertised, a normal terrestrial planet. After the months of space and the loss of Chandra K, the sight caught Ravna short. Ocean. The world was mostly ocean. But near the Terminator, there were the darker shades of land. A single tiny moon was visible beyond the limb. Fom sucked in his breath. It's about 10,000 kilometers off. Perfect. Except for it closing at 70 clicks per second. Even as she watched, the world seemed to grow, falling toward them. Fom watched it for a few seconds more. Don't worry, we're going to miss. Fly right past the, north limb. The globe swelled below them, eclipsing the moon. She had always loved the appearance of Herta at Chandra K. But that world had smaller oceans and was crisscrossed with dirochemy paths. This place was as beautiful as Relay and seemed truly untouched. The small polar cap was in sunlight, and she could follow the coastline that came south from it toward the Terminator. I'm seeing the northwest coast. Yefri's right down there. Ravna reached for her keyboard, asking the ship to attempt both ultra-wave comm and a radio link. Ultra-wave contact, she said after a second. What does it say?
It's garbled, probably just a ping response.
Acknowledgement to OOB's signal, the most that had been possible since the surge. Yefri was housed very near the ship these days. Sometimes she had gotten responses almost immediately, even during his nighttime. It would be good to talk to him again, even if... Tyne's world filled half the windows now, its limb a barely curving horizon. Sky colors stood before them, fading to the black of space. Ice cap and icebergs showed detail within detail against the sea. She could see cloud shadows. She followed the coast southwards, islands and peninsulas so closely fit that she could not be sure of one from the other. Blackish mountains and black-striped glaciers, green and brown valleys. She tried to remember the geography they had learned from Yefri. Hidden island? But there were so many islands. I have radio contact from the planet's surface, came the ship's voice. Simultaneously, a blinking arrow pointed at a spot just in from the coast. Do you want the audio in real time?
Yes, yes, said Ravna, then punched at her keyboard when the ship did not respond immediately.
Hi, Ravna. Oh, Ravna.
The little boy's voice bounced excitement around the deck. He sounded just as she had imagined. Ravna keyed in a request for two-way. They were less than 5,000 clicks from Yefri now, even if they were sweeping by at 70 kilometers per second. Plenty close enough for a radio conversation.
Hi, Yefri, she said. We're here at last, but we need...
We need all the cooperation your four-legged friends can give us. How to say that quickly and effectively. But the boy on the ground already had an agenda.
Need help now, Ravna. The woodcarvers are attacking now.
There was a thumping as if the transmitter was bouncing around. Another voice spoke, high-pitched and weirdly inarticulate.
"This steel, Ravna. Jeffrey Wright, woodcarver."
The almost human voice dissolved into a hissing gobble. After a moment, she heard Jeffrey's voice.
"Ambush. The word is ambush." "Yes. Woodcarver has done big, big ambush. They all around now. We die in hours if you not help."
Woodcarver had never wanted to be a warrior, but ruling for 500,000 years requires a range of skills, and she had learned about making war. Some of that, such as trusting to staff, she had temporarily unlearned these last few days. There had indeed been an ambush on Margrim Climb, but not the one that Lord Steele had planned. She looked across the tented field at Vindacious. That pack was half-hidden by noise battles, but she could see he wasn't so jaunty as before. Being put to the question will loosen anyone's control. Vindacious knew his survival now depended on her keeping a promise. Yet, it was awful to think that Vindacious would live after he had killed and betrayed so many. She realized that two of herself were keening rage, lips curled back from clenched teeth. Her puppies huddled back from threats unseen. The tented area stank of sweat and the mind noise of too many people in too small a space. It took a real effort of will to calm herself. She licked the puppies and daydreamed peaceful thoughts for a moment. Yes, she would keep her promises to him, and maybe it would be worth the price. Vindacious had only speculations about Steele's inner secrets, but he had learned far more about Steele's tactical situation than the other side could have guessed. Vindacious had known just where the Flensurists were hiding and in what numbers. Steele's folk had been overconfident about their super guns and their secret traitor. When Woodcarver's troops surprised them, victory had been easy, and now the Queen had some of the marvelous guns. From behind the hills, those cannons were still pounding away, eating through the stocks of ammunition the captured gunners had revealed. Vindacious the traitor had cost her much, but Vindacious the prisoner might yet bring her victory. "Woodcarver?" It was Scrupolo. She waved him closer. Her chief gunner edged out of the sun, sitting down an intimate 25 feet away. Battle conditions had blown away all notions of decorum. Scrupolo's mind noise was an anxious jumble. He looked by parts exhausted and exhilarated and discouraged.
"It's safe to advance up the castle hill, Your Majesty," he said. "Answering fire is almost extinguished. Parts of the castle walls have been breached. There is an end to castles here, my queen. Even our own poor cannons would make it so."
She bobbed agreement. Scrupolo spent most of his time with Dataset in learning to make cannons in particular. Woodcarver spent her time learning what those inventions ultimately created. By now she knew far more than even Johanna about the social effects of weapons, from the most primitive to one so strange that they seemed not weapons at all. 1,000,000,000 times castle technologies had fallen to things like cannon. Why should her world be different?
"We'll move up, then."
From beyond the shade of the tent, there was a faint whistle, a rare incoming round. She folded the puppies within herself and paused a moment. 20 yards away, Vindacious shrank down in a great cower. But when it came, the explosion was a muffled thump above them on the hill. It might even have been one of our own.
"Now our troops must take advantage of the destruction. I want Steele to know that the old games of ransom and torture will only win him worse."
"We'll most likely win the starship and the child. The question was, would either be alive when they got them?" She hoped Johanna would never know the threats and the risks she planned for the next few hours.
"Yes, Majesty."
But Scrupolo made no move to depart and suddenly seemed more bedraggled and worried than ever.
"Woodcarver, I fear..."
"What? We have the tide. We must rush to sail on it."
"Yes, Majesty.
But while we move forward, there are serious dangers coming up on our flanks and rear, the enemy's far scouts and the fires.
Scrupolo was right. The Flancerists who operated behind her lines were deadly. There weren't many of them. The enemy troops at Margram Climb had been mostly killed or dispersed. The few that ate at Woodcarver's flanks were equipped with ordinary crossbows and axes, but they were extraordinarily well-coordinated, and their tactics were brilliant. She saw the snouts and tines of Flenser himself in that brilliance. Somehow her evil child lived. Like a plague of years past, he was slipping back upon the world. Given time, those guerrilla packs would seriously hurt Woodcarver's ability to supply her forces. Given time. Two of her stood and looked Scrupolo in the eyes, emphasizing the point.
All the more reason to move now, my friend. We are the ones far from home. We are the ones with limited numbers and food. If we don't win soon, then we will be cut up a bit at a time.
Flensed.
Scrupolo stood up, nodding submission.
That's what Peregrine says, too. And Johanna wants to chase right through the castle walls. But there's something else, Your Majesty. Even if we must lunge all forward, I worked for a 10 of 10 days using every clue I could understand from dataset to make our cannon. Majesty, I know how hard it is to do such, yet the guns we captured on Margram have 3 times the range and 1/4 the weight. How could they do it?
There were chords of anger and humiliation in his voice.
The traitor, Scrupolo jerked a snout in the direction of Vendacious, thinks they may have Johanna's brother, but Johanna says they have nothing like dataset. Majesty, Steele has some advantage we don't yet know.
Even the executions were not helping. Day by day, Steele felt his rage growing. Alone on the parapet, he whipped back and forth upon himself, barely conscious of anything but his anger. Not since he had been under Flenser's knife had the anger been such a radiant thing. Get back control before he cuts you more, the voice of some early Steele seemed to say. He hung on the thought, pulled himself together. He stared down at bloody drool and tasted ashes. 3 of his shoulders were streaked with tooth cuts. He'd been hurting himself, another habit Flenser had cured him of long ago. Hurt outwards, never toward yourself. Steele licked mechanically at the gashes and walked closer to the parapet's edge. At the horizon, gray-black haze obscured the sea and the islands. The last few days, the summer winds had been a hot breath tasting of smoke. Now the winds were like fire themselves, whipping past the castle, carrying ash and smoke. All last day around, the far side of Bitter Gorge had been a haze of fire. Today he could see the hillsides. They were black and brown, crowned with smoke that swept toward the sea's horizon. There were often brush and forest fires in the high summer. But this year, as if nature was a godly pack of war, the fires had been everywhere. The wretched guns had done it. And this year he couldn't retreat to the cool of Hidden Island and leave the coastlings to suffer.
Steele ignored his smarting shoulders and paced the stones more thoughtfully, almost analytical for a change. The creature Vendacious had not stayed bought. He had turned traitor to his treason. Steele had anticipated that Vendacious might be discovered. He had other spies who should have reported such a thing, but there had been no sign until the disaster at Margram Climb. Now the twist of Vendacious's knife had turned all his plans on their heads. Woodcarver would be here very soon, and not as a victim. Who would have guessed that he would really need the spacers to rescue him from Woodcarver? He had worked so hard to confront the Southerners before Ravna arrived. But now he did need that help from the sky, and it was more than 5 hours away. Steele almost slipped back into rage state at the thought. In the end, would all the cousining of Amdi Yefri be for nothing? Oh, when this is over,
how much will I enjoy killing those two? More than any of the others, they deserved death. They had caused so much inconvenience. They had consistently required his kindliest behavior, as though they ruled him. They had showered him with more insolence than 10,000 normal subjects. From the castle yard there was the sound of laboring packs, straining wenches, the screech and groan of rock being moved about. The professional core of Flenser's empire survived. Given a few more hours, the breaches in the walls would be repaired, and new guns would be brought in from the north. And the grand scheme can still succeed. As long as I am together, no matter what else is lost, it can succeed. Almost lost in the racket, he heard the click of claws on the inward steps. Steele drew back, turned all heads toward the sound. Shrek? But Shrek would have announced himself first. Then he relaxed. There was only one set of claw sounds. It was a singleton coming up the stairs. Flenser's member cleared the steps and bowed to Steele, an incomplete gesture without other members to mirror it. The member's radio cloak shone clean and dark. The army was in awe of those cloaks, and of the singletons and duos who seemed smarter than the brightest pack. Even Steele's lieutenants, who understood what the cloaks really were, even Shrek, were cautious and tentative around them. And now Steele needed the Flenser fragment more than anyone, more than anything except starfolk gullibility.
What news?
Leave to sit? Was the sardonic Flenser smile behind that request?
Granted,
snapped Steele. The singleton eased itself onto the stones, but Steele saw when the other winced. The fragment had been dispersed across the domain for almost 20 days now. Except for brief periods, he had been wrapped in the radio cloaks that whole time. Dark and golden torture. Steele had seen this member without its cloak when it was bathed. Its pelt was rubbed raw at shoulder and haunch, where the weight of the radio was greatest. Bleeding sores had opened at the center of the bald spots. Alone without its cloak, the mindless singleton had blabbered its pain. Steele enjoyed those sessions, even if this one was not especially verbal. It was almost as if he, Steele, were now the one who teaches with a knife, and Flenser were his pupil. The singleton was silent for a moment. Steele could hear its ill-concealed panting.
The last day around has gone well, my lord.
Not here. We've lost almost all our cannon. We're trapped inside these walls.
And the starfolk may arrive too late.
I mean out there.
The singleton poked its nose toward the open spaces beyond the parapet.
Your scouts are well trained, my lord, and have some bright commanders. Right now I am spread round Woodcarver's rear and flanks.
The singleton made its part of a laughing gesture.
Rear and flanks. Funny. To me, Woodcarver's entire army is like a single enemy pack. Our attack infantries are like tines on my own paws. We are cutting the queen deep, my lord. I set the fire in Bitter Gorge. Only I could see exactly where it was spreading, exactly how to kill with it. And another 4 day arounds, there will be nothing left of the queen's supplies. She will be ours.
Too long, if we're dead this afternoon.
Yes.
The singleton cocked its head at Steele. He's laughing at me. Just like all those times under Flenser's knife, when a problem would be posed and death was the penalty for failure.
But Ravna and company should be back here in 5 hours, no?
Steele nodded.
Well, I guarantee you that will be hours ahead of Woodcarver's main assault. You have Omdi Yefri's confidence. It seems you need only advance and compress your previous schedule. If Ravna is sufficiently desperate...
The Starfolk are desperate. I know that.
Ravna might mask her precise motives, but her desperation was clear.
And if you can slow Woodcarver... Steele settled all of himself down to concentrate on the scheming at hand. He was half conscious of his fears retreating. Planning was always a comfort. The problem is that we have to do two things now, and perfectly coordinated. Before, it was simply a matter of feigning a siege and tricking the starship into our castle's jaws. He turned ahead in the direction of the courtyard. The stone dome over the landed starship had been in place since mid-spring. It showed some artillery damage now, the marble facing chipped away, but it hadn't taken direct hits. Beside it lay the field of the jaws, large enough to accept the rescue ship, but surrounded by pillars of stone, the teeth of the jaws. With the proper use of gunpowder, the teeth would fall on the rescuers. That would be a last resort if they didn't kill and capture the humans as they came out to meet dear Yefri. That scheme had been lovingly honed over many 10 days, aided by Omdi Yefri's admissions about human psychology and his knowledge of how spaceships normally land. But now... Now we really need their help. What I asked them must do double duty, to fool them and to destroy Woodcarver.
Hard to do all at once, agreed the cloak. Why not play it in two steps, the first more or less undeceitful? Have them destroy Woodcarver, then worry about taking them over.
Steele clicked a time thoughtfully on stone. Yes. Trouble is... If they see too much, they can't possibly be as naive as Yefri. He says that humankind has a history that includes castles and warfare. If they fly around too much, they'll see things that Yefri never saw or never understood. Maybe I could get them to land inside the castle and mount weapons on the walls. We'll have them hostage the moment that they stand between our jaws. Damn. That would take some clever work with Omdi Yefri. The bliss of abstract planning foundered for a moment on rage. It's getting harder and harder for me to deal with those two. They're both holy puppies, for Pax's sake. The fragment paused a second.
Of course, Omdi Ranafani may have more raw intelligence than any Pax I've ever seen. You think he may even be smart enough to see past his... childishness,
he used the Somnorsh word,
and see the deception?
No, not that. I have their necks in my jaws, and they still don't see it. You're right, Tyrethect. They do love me. And how I hate them for it. When I'm around him, the mantis thing is all over me, close enough to cut my throat or poke out my eyes, but hugging and petting... and expecting me to love him back. Yes, they believe everything I say, but the price is accepting unending insolence.
Be cool, dear student. The heart of manipulation is to empathize without being touched.
The fragment stopped, as always, just short of the brink. But this time Steele felt himself hissing at the words even before he was consciously aware of his reaction.
Don't! Lecture me? You are not Flenser. You are a fragment. Shit. You are a fragment of a fragment now. A word and you will be cut up dead in 1,000 pieces.
He tried to suppress the trembling that spread through his members. Why haven't I killed him before now? I hate Flenser more than anything in the world, and it would be so easy. Yet the fragment was always so indispensable... somehow the only thing between Steele and failure. And he was under Steele's control. And the singleton was doing a very good terrified cower.
Sit up, you. Give me your counsel and not your lectures, and you will live. Whatever the reason, it's impossible for me to carry on the charade with these puppies. Perhaps for a few minutes at a time I can do it, or if there are other packs to keep them away from me... But none of this unending loving. Another hour of that, and I know I'll start killing them. So, I want you to talk with Omdi Yefri. Explain the situation. Explain...
But...
The singleton was looking at him in astonishment.
I'll be watching. I'm not giving up those two to your possession. Just handle the close diplomacy.
The fragment drooped, the pain in its shoulders undisguised.
If that is your wish, my lord.
Steele showed all his teeth.
It is indeed. Just remember, I'll be present for everything important, especially direct radio communication.
He waved the singleton off the parapet.
Now go and cuddle up to the children. Learn something of self-control yourself.
After the cloak was gone, he called Shrek up to the parapet. The next few hours were spent touring the defenses and planning with his staff. Steele was very surprised how much clearing up the puppy problem improved his quality of mind. His advisors seemed to pick up on it, relaxed to the point of offering substantive suggestions.
Where the breaches in the walls could not be repaired, they would build deadfalls. The cannon from the northern shops would arrive before the end of the day around, and one of Shrek's people had worked out an alternate plan for food and water resupply. Reports from the far scouts showed steady progress, a withering of the enemy's rear. They would lose most of their ammunition before they reached Starship Hill. Even now, there was scarcely any shot falling on the hill. As the sun rose in the south, Steele was back on the parapets, scheming on just what to say to the star folk. This was almost like earlier days when plans went well and success was wondrous yet achievable. And yet, at the back of his mind, all the hours since talking with the singleton, there had been the little claws of fear. Steele had the appearance of ruling. The Flenser fragment gave the appearance of following. But even though it was spread across miles, the pack seemed more together than ever before. Oh, in earlier times, the fragment often pretended equilibrium, but its internal tension always showed. Lately, it seemed self-satisfied, almost smug. The Flenser fragment was responsible for the domain's forces south of Starship Hill, and after today, after Steele had forced the responsibility upon him, the cloaks would be with Omdi Yefri every day. Never mind that the motivation had come from within Steele. Never mind that the fragment was in an obvious state of agonized exhaustion. In its full genius, the Great One could have charmed a forest wolf into thinking Flenser its queen. And do I really know what he's saying to the packs beyond my hearing? Could my spies be feeding me lies about him? Now that he had a moment away from immediate concerns, these little claws dug deeper. I need him, yes, but the margin for error is smaller now. After a moment, he grated a happy chord, accepting the risk. If necessary, he would use what he had learned with the second set of cloaks, something he had artfully concealed from Flenser Tyrethect. If necessary, the fragment would find that death can be radio swift. Even as he flew the velocity match, Fom was working the ultra drive. This would save them hours of flyback time, but it was a chancy game, one the ship had never been designed for. OOB bounced all around the solar system. One really lucky jump was all they needed, and one really unlucky jump into the planet would kill them. A good reason why this game was not normally played. After hours of hacking the flight automation, of playing ultra-drive roulette, poor Fom's hands were faintly trembling. Whenever Tyne's world came back into view, often no more than a far point of blue light, he would glare for a second at it. Ravna could see the doubts rising within him. His memories told him he should be good with low-tech automation, yet some of the OOB primitives were almost impenetrable. Or maybe his memories of competence of the Cheng Ho were cheap fakes.
The Blighter fleet. How long? Asked Fom.
Greenstalk was watching the nav window from the rider's cabin. It was the fifth time the question had been asked in the last hour, yet her voice came back calm and patient.
Maybe the repeated questions even seemed a natural thing.
Range, 49 light-years. Estimated time of arrival, 48 hours. 7 more ships have dropped out.
Ravna could subtract. 152 were still coming. Blueshell's voter sounded over his mates.
During the last 200 seconds, they have made slightly better time than before, but I think that is local variance and bottom conditions. Sir Fahm, you were doing well, but I know my ship. We could get a little more time if only you'd allow me control. Please,
shut up. Fahm's voice was sharp, but the words were almost automatic. It was a conversation, or the abortion of one, that occurred almost as often as Fahm's demand for status info on the Blighter fleet. In the early weeks of their journey, she had assumed that Godshatter was somehow superhuman. Instead, it was parts and pieces, automation loaded in a great panic. Maybe it was working right, or maybe it had run amok and was tearing Fahm apart with its errors. The old cycle of fear and doubt was suddenly broken by soft blue light. Tyne's world. At last, a wondrously accurate jump, almost as good as the shocker of 5 hours before. 20,000 kilometers away hung a vast, narrow crescent, the edge of planetary daylight.
The rest was a dark blot against the stars, except where the auroral ring hung a faint green glow around the south pole.
Yefri Olshendot was on the other side of the world from them, in the Arctic day. They wouldn't have radio communication until they arrived, and she hadn't figured out how to recalibrate the ultra-wave for short-range transmission. She turned back from the view. Fahm still stared upward into the sky behind her.
Fahm, what good is 48 hours? Will we just destroy the countermeasure?
What of Yefri and Mr. Steele's people?
Maybe, but there are other possibilities. There must be.
That last softly.
I've been chased before. I've been in bigger jams before.
His eyes avoided hers. Chapter 38. Yefri hadn't seen the sky for more than an hour in the last 2 days. He and Damdi were safe enough in the great stone dome that sheltered the refugee ship, but there was no way to see outside. If it weren't for Omdi, I couldn't have stood it a minute. In some ways, it was worse even than his first days on Hidden Island. The ones who killed Mom and Dad and Johanna were just a few kilometers away. They had captured some of Mr. Steele's guns, and the last few days the explosions had gone on for hours, a booming that shook the ground beneath them and sometimes even smashed at the walls of the dome. Their food was brought in to them, and when they weren't sitting in the ship's command cabin, the two wandered outside the ship to the rooms with the sleeping children. Yefri had kept up with the simple maintenance procedures he remembered, but looking through the chill trance of the cold sleep coffins, he was terribly afraid. Some of them weren't breathing very much. The inside temperature seemed too high, and he and Damdi didn't know how to help. Nothing had changed here, but now there was joy. Ravna's long silence had ended. Omdi Yefri and Mr. Steele had actually talked to her in voice. 3 more hours, and her ship would be here. Even the bombardment had ended, almost as if Woodcarver realized that her time was near to ending. 3 more hours. Left to himself, Yefri would have spent the time in a state of wall-climbing anxiety. After all, he was 9 years old now, a grown-up with grown-up problems. But then there was Omdi. The pack was much smarter than Yefri in some ways, but he was such a little kid, about 5 years old, as near as Omdi Yefri could figure it. Except when he was into heavy thinking, he could not stay still. After the call from Ravna, Yefri wanted to sit down for serious worrying, but Omdi began chasing himself around the pylons. He shouted back and forth in Yefri's voice and Ravna's and bumped into the boy accidentally on purpose. Yefri hopped up and glared at the careening puppies. just a little kid. And suddenly, happy and so sad all at once, is this how Johanna saw me? And so he had responsibilities now, too, like being patient. As one of Omdi came rushing past his knees, Jeffrey swept down to grab the wriggling form. He raised it to shoulder level as the rest of the pack converged gleefully, pounding on him from all directions. They fell to the dry moss and wrestled for a few seconds.
"Let's explore! Let's explore! We have to be here for Ravna and Mr. Steele. Don't worry, we'll remember when."
"Okay." Where was there really to go? The two walked through the torch-lit dimness to the clear story that ringed the inner edge of the dome. As far as Jeffrey could see, they were alone. That was not unusual. Mr. Steele was very worried that woodcarver spies might get into the ship. Even his own soldiers rarely came here. Amda Jeffrey had investigated the inside wall before. Behind the quilts, the stone felt cool and damp. There were some holes to the outside for ventilation, but they were almost 10 meters up, where the wall was already curving inwards toward the apex of the dome. The stone was rough-cut, not yet polished. Mr. Steele's workers had been in a frantic hurry to complete the protection before Woodcarver's army arrived. Nothing was polished, and the quilts were undecorated. Ahead and behind him, Omdi was sniffing at the cracks and fresh mortar. The one in Jeffrey's arms gave a concerted wiggle.
"Ha! Up ahead! I knew that mortar was coming loose," the pack said.
Jeffrey let all of his friends rush forward to a nook in the wall. It didn't look any different than before, but Omdi was scratching with 5 pairs of paws.
"Even if you can get it loose, what good does it do you?"
Jeffrey had seen these blocks as they were lowered into place. They were almost 50 centimeters across, laid in alternating rows. Getting past one would just bring them to more stone.
"Ha-ha, I don't know. I've been saving this up till we had some time to kill. Yuck, this mortar burns my lips."
More scratching, and the pack passed back a fragment as big as Jeffrey's head. There really was a hole between the blocks, and it was big enough for Omdi. One of them darted into the tiny cave. Satisfied, Jeffrey plunked himself down by the hole and tried to look in.
"Guess what?"
Omdi's shrill came from a member right by his ear.
"There's a tunnel back here, not just another layer of stone."
A member wriggled past Jeffrey and disappeared into the dark. Secret tunnels? That was too much like a New Yoran fairy tale.
"These are big enough for a full-grown member, Jeffrey. You could get through these on hands and knees."
2 more of Omdi disappeared into the hole. The tunnel he had discovered might be large enough for a human child, but the entrance hole was a tight fit even for the puppies. Jeffrey had nothing to do but stare into the darkness. The parts of Omdi that remained at the entrance talked about what he had found.
"Goes on for a long, long way. I've doubled back a couple of times. The top of me is about 5 meters up, way over your head. This is kooky. I'm getting all strung out."
Omdi sounded even sillier than his normal playfulness. 2 more of him went into the hole. This was developing into serious adventure that Jeffrey could have no part of.
"Don't go too far. It might be dangerous."
One of the pair that remained looked up at him.
"Don't worry, don't worry. The tunnel isn't an accident. It feels like it was cut as grooves in the stones when they were laid. This is some special escape route Mr. Steele made. I'm all right, I'm all right. Ha ha, hoo hoo."
1 more disappeared into the hole. After a moment, the last remaining one ran in, but stayed near enough to the entrance so Omdi could still talk to Jeffrey. The pack was having a high old time, singing and screeching to itself. Jeffrey knew exactly what the other was up to. It was another of the games he could never play. In this posture, Omdi's thoughts would be the weirdest rippling things. Darn. Now that he was playing within stone, it must be even neater than before, since he was totally cut off from all thoughts except from member to adjacent member. The stupid singing went on a little longer, and then Omdi spoke in an almost reasonable tone.
"Hi, this tunnel actually splits off in places.
The front of me has come to a fork. One side is heading down. Wish I had enough members to go both ways.
Well, you don't. Hi-ho, I'll take the upper tunnel today.
A few seconds of silence.
There's a little door here, like a member-sized room door. Not locked.
Omdi relayed the sounds of stone scritching against stone.
Ha, I can see light. Up just a few more meters. It opens onto a window. Hear the wind?
He relayed wind sound and the keening of the seabirds that soared up from Hidden Island. It sounded wonderful.
Oh, this is stretching things, but I want to look out. Yefri, I can see the sun. I'm outdoors, sitting way up on the side of the dome. I can see all round to the south. Boy, it's smoky down there.
What about the hillside? Yefri asked the nearest member. Its white splotched pelt was barely visible through the entrance hole.
At least Omdi was staying in touch.
A little browner than last 10 day. I don't see any soldiers out there.
Yefri heard the relayed sound of a cannon firing.
Yipes! They're shooting, though. It hit just on this side of the crest. Someone's out there, just below my line of sight.
Woodcarver, come at last. Yefri shivered, angry that he couldn't see, frightened of what might be seen. He often had nightmares about what Woodcarver must truly be, how she had done it to Mom and Dad and Johanna. Images never fully formed, yet almost memories. Mr. Steele will get Woodcarver.
Uh-oh, old Tyrethect is coming across the castle yard this way.
Thumping sounds came from the hole as Omdi blundered back down. No point in letting Tyrethect know that there was a tunnel hidden in the wall. He'd probably just order them to stay away from it. 1, 2, 3, 4. Half of Omdi popped out of the wall. The four wandered around a little dazedly. Yefri couldn't tell if it was because of their stretched-out experience or if they were temporarily split from the other half of the pack.
Act natural! Act natural!
Then the other four arrived, and Omdi began to settle down. He led Yefri away from the wall at a fast trot.
Let's get the comm set. We'll pretend we've been trying to raise Ravna with it.
Omdi knew well that the starship couldn't be back for another 30 minutes or so. In fact, he had been the one who verified the deceleration math for Mr. Steele. Nevertheless, he chased up the ship's steps and dragged down the radio. The two were already plugging the antenna into a signal booster when the public doors on the west side of the dome were unlatched. Silhouetted against the daylight were parts of a guard pack and a single member of Tyrethect. The guard retired, sliding the door shut, and the cloak walked slowly across the moss towards them. Omdi rushed over and chattered about their attempts to use the radio. It was a little forced, Yefri thought. The puppies were still confused by their trip through the walls. The singleton looked at the powdering of mortar dust on Omdi's pelt.
You've been climbing in the walls, haven't you?
What?
Omdi looked himself over, noticed the dust. Usually he was more clever.
Yes,
he said shamefacedly. He brushed the powder away.
You won't tell, will you?
Fat chance he'll help us, thought Yefri. Mr. Tyrethect had learned Somnorsh better than Mr. Steele, and besides Steele, was the only one who had much time to talk with them. But even before the radio cloaks, he'd been a short-tempered, bossy sort. Yefri had had babysitters like him. Tyrethect was nice up to a point, and then would get sarcastic or say something mean. Lately, that had improved, but Yefri still didn't like him much. But Mr. Tyrethect didn't say anything right away. He sat down slowly, as if his rump hurt.
No, I won't tell.
Yefri exchanged a surprised glance with one of Omdi.
What is the tunnel for? He asked timidly.
All castles have hidden tunnels, especially in the domain of Mr. Steele. You want ways to escape, ways to spy on your enemies.
The singleton shook its head.
Never mind. Is your radio properly receiving, Omdi Yefri?
Omdi cocked a head at the comms display.
I think so, but there's nothing yet to receive. See, Ravna's ship had to decelerate, and,
I could show you the arithmetic?
But Mr. Tyrefect was obviously not interested in playing with chalkboards.
Well, depending on their luck with the ultra drive, we should have radio contact with them real soon.
But the little window on the comm showed no incoming signal. They watched it for several minutes. Mr. Tyrefect lowered his muzzle and seemed to sleep. Every few seconds his body twitched. Jeffrey wondered what the rest of him was doing. Then the comm window was glowing green. There was a garble of sound as it tried to sort signal from background noise.
"Over you in 5 minutes," came Rovna's voice. "Jeffrey, are you listening?" "Yes, we're here." "Let me talk to Mr. Steele, please."
Mr. Tyrefect stepped nearer to the comm.
"He is not here now, Rovna. Who is this?"
Tyrefect's laugh was a giggle. He had never heard any other kind.
"I?"
He made the tinish chord that sounded like Tyrefect to Jeffrey.
"Or do you mean a taken name like Steele? I don't know the exact word. You may call me Mr. Skinner."
Tyrefect laughed again.
"For now, I can speak for Steele. Jeffrey, are you all right?" "Yes, yes, listen to Mr. Skinner."
What a strange name. The sounds from the comm became muffled. There was a male voice arguing. Then Ravna was back, her voice kind of tight, like Mom when she was mad.
"Jeffrey, what's the volume of a ball 10 centimeters across?"
Omdi had been fidgeting impatiently through the conversation. All through the last year, he had been hearing stories of humans from Jeffrey and dreaming what Ravna might really be like. Now he had a chance to show off. He jumped for the comm and grinned at Jeffrey.
"That's easy, Ravna."
His voice was perfect to Jeffrey and completely fluent.
"It's 523.598 cubic centimeters. Or do you want more digits?"
Muffled conversation.
"No, that's fine. Okay, Mr. Skinner, we have pictures from our earlier pass and a general radio fix. Where exactly are you?"
"Under the castle dome at the top of Starship Hill. It's right at the coast by a..."
A man's voice cut in. "Fom?" He had a funny accent.
"I got it on the map. We still can't see you direct. Too much haze."
"That's smoke," said the cloak. "The enemy is almost upon us from the south. We need your help immediately."
End of side 14. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.